From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I feel any Negro, if he were honest, would have to say that even in our democracy as at present, that he is never any one second unconscious of the fact that he is a Black American.
Paul Robeson was born 100 years ago today. We bring you a special on a man his friends dearly remember.
Athletic champion, yes. Fight, better, Kappa scholar, singer, actor, spokesman, activist, leader, yes. Africanist, socialist, Black nationalist, all that. But something more, something new.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton says comprehensive tobacco legislation will go forward with or without the industry's cooperation. Yesterday, RJR Nabisco, which makes Camel cigarettes, pulled out of the negotiations. The federal government is trying to hold tobacco companies liable for Medicaid expenses incurred for tobacco-related illnesses. But the companies say the settlement that passed the Senate Commerce Committee last week goes too far by not protecting them from future lawsuits. After RJR pulled out, other companies issued statements of support. Some lawmakers say the companies are bluffing. Last June, a proposed settlement would have protected cigarette companies from future liability. However, it was criticized as too lenient. Teamsters for a Democratic Union, a group of Teamsters that long supported Ron Kerry, the union's president, announced yesterday that it's backing Ken Hall, head of the union's small package division, in upcoming elections for the union's presidency. With this move, the forces that back Kerry have largely coalesced around Hall, a 41-year-old West Virginian, who asserts that he'll be the reform candidate against James P. Hoffa, son of the former president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Many Kerry supporters are turning to Hall after Kerry, who's on leave from the presidency, was barred from running for re-election when a federal monitor found that he'd conspired to siphon union money into his re-election campaign in 1996. The widow of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. yesterday met with Attorney General Janet Reno to present what she called new evidence of a conspiracy in her husband's assassination in hopes of persuading the federal government to re-examine the crime. Coretta Scott King met for more than 2 hours with Reno to press the case for appointment of a federal panel styled on South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would have subpoena power and would grant immunity to potential witnesses. New witnesses have come forth who've never been investigated, King said, adding that their testimony should be heard by a formal, unbiased commission. The meeting with Reno marked the most serious interest the federal government has taken in the assassination since Congress investigated the matter 2 decades ago. New guidelines enforcing a Pentagon policy barring pursuit and harassment of gay men and lesbians in the military were ordered by Defense Secretary William Cohen. Some commanders haven't gotten the message, Cohen said in an NPR interview. He made the comment after the Defense Department released a report showing the number of people discharged for homosexuality had climbed 67% since 1994, when the current policy took effect. The official record of United States foreign policy stands in danger of becoming an official lie if the Central Intelligence Agency keeps refusing to release Cold War documents from the 1950s and 1960s. This according to a State Department Historians Committee, which is warning this in a forthcoming report. The refusal to publish Cold War history is, quote, a violation of the law and of American standards, the committee and its chair said in a report and letter to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. It goes on to say this republic cannot survive if government is secret and not held accountable for its actions. Under the law, government records should be available to the public after 30 years once they've been cleansed of potentially harmful secrets like the names of covert agents. But the CIA has not been able to live up to the law. Apartheid-era President P.W. Botha of South Africa is fit to stand trial next week for refusing to testify at South Africa's Truth Commission, this according to prosecutors today. Botha said in, or the Attorney General in Botha's home province of Western Cape said, I have carefully considered all the circumstances and evidence, and I'm satisfied that Botha is fit to stand trial. He is due in the George Regional Court to face charges of contempt for refusing to testify to the Statutory Truth and Reconciliation Commission about his State Security Council, an inner cabinet which upheld apartheid through emergency rule in the 1980s. An American church delegation left for Baghdad today with $100,000 worth of medicine and surgical supplies to help the Iraqi people. Reverend Rodney Page heads a 7-member delegation, which he said will spend Easter Sunday with members of the Chaldean Christian minority in Iraq. They also will visit hospitals in Baghdad to donate $100,000 worth of antibiotics and surgical material. The UN, pushed by the U.S. in 1990, imposed devastating sanctions against Iraq. The council has donated $3 million worth of medicine to Iraqis since 1990. And finally, Israel Military Industries said today it intends to manufacture in the U.S. weapons modeled on its Uzi gun to get around opposition in Washington to their import. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Paul Robeson was born 100 years ago today, on April 9, 1898, in Princeton, New Jersey. His father was a slave. From World War I, Robeson's achievements put him in the spotlight. He first won national fame as the first black man to play football on a white team at Rutgers University. Robeson then rose to international renown as a singer and actor. He played Othello in London and traveled the world singing before audiences from New York to Beijing to Moscow. But soon the man who W.E.B. Du Bois called the best-known American on earth would become the target of the vicious wish hunts of the McCarthy era. Robeson's ordeal before the House Un-American Activities Committee did not end with his non-cooperation at his hearing. To the U.S. government, Robeson was a man to be feared. To the movement for justice and equality, he was a deity. His career as an actor and singer became secondary to his fight against fascism, imperialism, and racism. In 1950, the government took away Robeson's passport. The State Department said he'd repeatedly criticized the conditions of Negroes in the United States. To this, Robeson replied, "So what? I have criticized those conditions abroad as I have at home, and I will continue to do so until those conditions are changed." He was charged with no crime, he had no trial, but he soon became a prisoner in the land of his birth. But that never stopped Robeson from standing against injustice. Legendary actor, singer, lawyer, linguist, and political activist Paul Robeson, born 100 years ago today. With speeches, songs, and rare interviews with both Paul Robeson and those who knew him, today on Democracy Now! We're going to celebrate the life and legacy of one of America's towering figures.
I would no more dare to introduce Paul Robeson than I would dare to assume that anybody here would need an introduction to Paul Robeson.
It began when I was a little boy in Princeton, New Jersey. Strange to say.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
And a little ragged group believed it, and some gentlemen and ladies believed it, and some wise men and some fools, and I believed it too, and you know who I am.
Yeah. How come all this?
Well, I'll tell you. It's like this.
We are here this evening to make an appreciation of the most remarkable human being I have ever met, Paul Robeson.
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. Always have been... I know I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you.
What is America to me? A name, a map of a flag I see. A certain word, a democracy. What is America to me? There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man I don't like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free?
It is encouraging today to see the ever-increasing opportunities and widening horizons for our Negro playwrights, actors and actresses, for our musicians in concert and in opera, and for our artists in almost every aspect of the cultural life of our country.
He must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along.
Yes, our languages, our idioms, our forms of expression may be different. Political, economic, and social systems under which we live may be different, but art reflects a common humanity. Much of the contemporary art reflecting our times has to do with the struggles for equality, human dignity, freedom, peace, and mutual understanding. The aspirations for a better life are similar indeed all over the world.
Now, I was born on the edge of Robeson County. And my father is a Robeson and was a Robeson because he was a slave, my own father, a slave of the Scottish Robesons who still control Robeson County in North Carolina. So I approach these problems from a very close point. But I have a home, and my people are tobacco workers and sharecroppers today on plantations in that county. But a part of that soil belongs to me. That's my roots. These are my roots in this country. I entered the sort of arena in the United States of fighting for social justice for my people in a concert, when I was in a concert in St. Louis in 1947. And the NAACP asked me in St. Louis at that time to come on a picket line because Negro people could not even sit in the theater, which was just across the street. And so I grabbed a banner. And a few nights later, when I was doing the concert, I said that I could not quite resolve the contradiction. And so I said that I was giving up my career technically for the moment to enter the realm of the day-to-day struggle of the Negro people especially.
These Klan-inspired and police-condoned hoodlums cannot stop the song of freedom in America. We're going on singing and presenting our concerts in every corner of America. Let's fight together.
We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder, rung by rung, higher and higher, until we find our freedoms, our complete equality in the lands of our birth.
You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail. But I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying, and old man River, he just keeps rolling along.
Legendary actor, singer, political activist Paul Robeson, born 100 years ago today. And thank you very much to WBAI producer Peter Beauchesne for that mix of Paul Robeson's words and songs. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This weekend in New York City, Paul Robeson's friends and admirers remembered him. Ozzie Davis was among them, an actor and friend of Paul Robeson. The event was sponsored by WBAI Pacifica Radio and The Nation magazine, as we all celebrated the life of Paul Robeson. This is some of what Ossie Davis had to say.
Thank you. You must learn to curb your enthusiasm, else I'll be encouraged to run for office. I bring you greetings from my mother, who will be 100 years old. And she wanted you to know that Paul wasn't the only great thing that happened in 1898. It wasn't great enough. It's wonderful and reassuring, safe, to see you seated here this Sunday morning talking about a man we love, admire, and still need. It wasn't too many years ago when, if we were gathered like this, most of us would be from the FBI and the CIA. But I'm assuming that upon guarantees that Paul really is dead, that they've been downsized and sense of mother. So the great beauty of Paul Robeson was partially expressed in the exciting response he was able to engender in anybody who came anywhere near him. It was impossible to be in Paul's presence without being taller and bigger and being able to speak more deeply and more excited than a moment before. Paul still has the capacity to bring people together and to organize people toward a common objective that elevates us all. Even now, after all these years, Paul is still able to do that. And this is one of the reasons why he was such a feared man. I'd like to read you something because it pinpoints what my feelings about Paul were, what they are now, and the challenge that I had. And maybe you too share this particular challenge. And in a group of articles, poems, and declarations about Paul that was put together by Freedom Ways, and the thing that I contributed, this is a part of what I had to say. Paul was a man and a half, and we have no category even now to hold the size of him. Something about him escapes our widest, most comprehensive embrace, and we've never been able to put our finger on exactly what it is. Athletic champion, yes. Phi Beta Kappa scholar, singer, actor, spokesman, activist, leader, yes. Africanist, socialist, black nationalist, all that. But something more, something new, something different. Paul spoke 25 languages, not as an exercise, but as a source through which he could absorb the many cultures into which he had not been born, but to which he was instinctively determined to belong. He consumed the language for the cultural essences it contained, and became in practice, in custom, and in habit, a loyal member of all the groups whose songs he sang. He had studied many lifestyles till they became his by second nature. He was himself transfigured by what he learned and became, almost by accident, what socialist societies are meant to produce by design. It may It just may be that Paul is socialist man. Now, I wrote the article because the question that Paul poses for me more than any other is the nature of the kind of human being we intend to create as a result of all these revolutionary impulses that we express if we build a socialist society. What kind of people can we call on to put into it?
Actor and political activist Ozzie Davis remembering his friend Paul Robeson today, the 100th anniversary of Paul Robeson's death. We'll go back to Ozzie Davis and then hear from Paul Robeson's friend and colleague Lloyd Brown. We'll also hear from Victor Novasky of The Nation magazine and Judge Margaret Burnham remembering their friend. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's ordering a cassette at the Pacifica Archives, 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in a minute.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man I don't like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? That old man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton. Them that plants him is soon forgotten, but old man River.
I would no more dare to introduce Paul Robeson than I would dare to assume that anybody here would need an introduction to Paul Robeson.
It began.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, as today we celebrate the 100th birthday of Paul Robeson, as we continue with political activist and actor Ozzie Davis remembering his friend Paul Robeson.
The challenge, what do we hope to find? What do we hope to build? What do we hope to create? What is possible for the human spirit if we can organize the material aspects of our society to produce, to stimulate, to grow? What are the objects of our educational institutions? Merely to prepare our children for better jobs with IBM? No, it has to do with who and what we want to become or see them become. We want them to be better human beings without being able fully to describe exactly what we mean by better human beings. And yet, poets and painters and dancers and sculptors, they shadow it forth all the time. And Paul, in who he was and how he expressed who he was, to me always exemplified what the beginnings of a new human being would be like. And let me close my few remarks by sharing what a poet with greater credentials than I had to say about this man. That time, we all heard it, cool and clear, cutting across the hot grit of the day, the major voice, the adult voice, foregoing rolling river, foregoing tearful tale of bale and barge and other symptoms of an old despond, warning in music words, devout and large, that we are each other's harvest, We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond. That was the poem Paul Robeson by Gwendolyn Brooks. Just last week, we lost a towering presence in the person and figure of Bella Abzug. When I felt and heard and saw Bella leave, my first response was that our capacity for moral indignation had been significantly reduced. How we need these great shakers and makers, how we need these thunderers on the mountaintop, how we need these agitators who expect more from the human spirit than what we are providing under the guidance of our merchants who use the most powerful instruments of our culture to sell us shoddy objects we do not need. What might it not be even now if Paul was here among us, exemplifying by his very presence a truer sense of the human potential? Would now our young black men fill more prison seats than college seats? Would we get news in the papers that even the young black males have taken to suicide as a way to express their futility with the vision of the world available to them? Where then is that vision? Those of us who have been believers, those of us who have walked with Paul, those of us who claim to have been inspired by Paul, how was it possible for us not to share with our children that which Paul made available to us by his presence and his life? I ask the question because the times ask me the question, and if I have a responsibility as an artist, as a devotee, as a believer, as a lover, should it not be to continue my search for the great magnificences exemplified in this man? I too have children. I too have grandchildren. All of them do not live in my house. Some of them are somewhere rotting in prison cells. The message of Paul might even now redeem them as Malcolm was redeemed when truth reached into his prison cell and struck the blinders from his eyes. Oh, Paul, we need you. We love you. You left us much work to be done. Thank you.
Actor and political activist Ozzie Davis remembering his friend Paul Robeson today, the 100th anniversary of Paul Robeson's birth. He was born April 9th, 1898. We now turn to Lloyd Brown, who was also a close friend of Robeson, worked with him as well. But before we turn to Lloyd Brown, we found a tape of Paul Robeson 30 years ago, actually in 1965, at a Freedom Ways magazine celebration, just after he had had his passport returned to him, talking about his friend Lloyd.
And also here is a friend and colleague, Mr. Lloyd Brown, distinguished writer who gave me such expert assistance with my work in connection with our fighting Negro newspaper of the 50s, happily called Freedom, and who also gave me such invaluable assistance in the organization and writing of the book, Here I Stand. Lloyd, would you please just say hello?
We now turn to Lloyd Brown, most recently his book, Young Paul Robeson, On My Journey Now.
I should say that I first became acquainted with Paul Robeson in 1946 when I got out of the Army. and became managing editor of a weekly magazine, left-wing magazine, called New Masses. Paul Robeson was a contributing editor of that magazine, as was W.B. Du Bois, and many other notable people. The novelist Howard Fast was a contributing editor, and others. That association with Paul Robeson soon led to action with him, because one of the first things that I became involved with was a mini march that he was the leader of in 1946, called the American Crusade to End Lynching. And he was co-chairman of a committee. Albert Einstein was the other one for that march on Washington. But before I go into this phase, the activity of Paul Robeson, I also want to say that in these last days, there have been many interesting connections which brought me back to happy days with Paul Robeson. For example, the day before yesterday, I got a call from Ray Stevenson, a retired officer of the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers of Canada, whom I met at a concert at the border. You know, when Paul wasn't allowed a passport, he wasn't allowed even to go to Canada. When you don't need a passport, the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers, when Paul was stopped from going, they organized the most wonderful, I guess it was maybe the happiest day of my life, one of them anyway, because you go to the Canadian border, just like you're all sitting here, instead of footlights or stage, we're on a flatbed truck. Paul is going to sing. The audience, if you can imagine, 30,000 people in a vast field sitting across the border. Canadians who came down from, there's no big city on the Canadian side near Peace Arch Park, it's near the little town of Blaine, Washington. These people came in cars and buses all the way from Vancouver, maybe 25 miles away, to come to hear Paul Robeson sing. It was absolutely, here's Paul, a prisoner, and here are his audiences. They've all come down, and I could just I could look at you now, I was looking at these people's faces, at the smiles, their happiness, for two reasons. One, because they love Paul Robeson, and secondly, because they were being un-American. They were defying un-American difference. You could see how they responded to Paul and his songs, this big support they got. So now, to get back to race, I met him there, one of the officers of this union. Day before yesterday, he called me and said, Lloyd, we've got some great news. The city of Toronto has officially declared April 9th as Paul Robeson Day. Mayor has announced it, and so it is official. April 9th, that's the largest city in Canada, is Paul Robeson Day. But Ray told, I said, well, we're not quite ready for that yet in New York. He says, I know, he says, Giuliani. So he's known in Toronto, too. Now, to go back to Paul Robeson as the man of action. As I said, we went to Washington. I was struck by a coincidence that I noted in my book. On Paul's birthday, the very day Paul was born, a black newspaper in Cleveland reported that a delegation, a woman, Ida B. Wells, had gone to see the president, who was then President McKinley. And what did she go to see him about? Against lynching, against the wave of lynching that was occurring in the United States at this time. So that the very moment Paul Robeson was born, a black leader went to the White House to protest lynching. And I thought of that, here was Paul, now in 1946, that he goes to see Truman, head of a delegation, did see Truman, and got nowhere with him. Those who went in with him told me that after Truman said no chance of anti-lynching bill, he's not going to issue any proclamation. He's not going to try to get the bill passed because of the Dixiecrat, he didn't call them Dixiecrats, Southern Democratic senators. We call them Dixiecrats, now they're all Republicans. And for the same reason, exactly the same reason, not what they were, but they haven't changed. They just changed their party designation. So when Paul said to Truman, well, if we don't get legislation, maybe we will just have to defend ourselves from lynch mobs. Truman was taken aback, they told me by that, and he said, no, no, Mr. Robeson. Let's not talk like that, okay? Violence. So this was my first involvement with Paul Robeson. Let me tell you something that is the essence, I think, of what kind of a person Paul was. On his plaque on his grave are words of his from a 1937 speech in London, where he says, the artist must elect to choose to fight for freedom or slavery. I have made my choice. I had no alternative. Now, why did he feel he had no alternative? Those were words that he said in his speech, and they were absolutely from the heart. That's what he meant. Well, why didn't he have any alternative? At that time, in 1937, he was at the top of the world. He was the biggest entertaining star in England. He made movies. He had a concert career. Why did he have no alternative but to make that secondary, in this case, to the fight against fascism? It came really from the kind of a person that he was and that his father raised him to be. When I found in his scrapbook a program of a family reunion in 1918 where Paul spoke, the title was Loyalty to Convictions. I asked Paul, what did you speak about? He says, I don't know. I don't remember it, but that must have been along the line my father taught me. So in 1919, when Paul graduated from Rutgers, the town gave him a banquet, the first interracial banquet they ever had in Rutgers. You know, when he was the hero of their football team, every year the football team had a banquet, Paul couldn't be there. No colored allowed. But they had this banquet when he graduated, and they gave Paul a purse. And then Paul, according to the newspaper, made a remark. He said that he intends that his life would be dedicated to the training he had received from his father, and he would dedicate himself to help the race to a higher level. Now, I'm sure everybody heard those words. They thought, oh, nice words from a young man who's going out. They didn't know that Paul Robeson meant that. That's what he meant, and his whole life was exactly that. In fact, there is a quotation. I have a quotation which really explains the essence of that. This is from Thoreau, who made a speech while they were, after John Brown was captured, but before they executed him. And Thoreau, speaking to his townspeople, made a speech from which I take these words. Action from principle, the perception and the performance of right, changes things and relations. It is wholly revolutionary. It not only divides states and churches, it divides families, it divides the individual, separating the diabolical in him from the divine. Action from principle. That was what Paul Robeson was. What his principles were, he took action on. And believing that, that is why he felt he had no alternative but to do what he had to do. In other words, what's right? Regardless. Paul didn't care anything about material goods. He wasn't concerned about money. He didn't think that money made anybody important. He felt you were only important by what you could contribute to the world. That established what your fulfillment of your own potential to do something for the human being. This was a thought that Paul Robeson always had. That was an aspect of his greatness, that he was a man utterly dedicated, utterly principled, consistent. When we were at the concert at the border, Paul Robeson recited a few words from a poem by Pablo Neruda. And I might say that this Paul Robeson was not born to be a warrior. He was an artist. And that's what he shouldn't have to do anything else but just be an artist. But circumstances forced him to become a warrior. But in this little poem from Neruda, Paul Robeson said, here Neruda speaks for me. These are the lines from Neruda. Let none think of me. Let us think of the entire earth and pound the table with love. I don't want blood again to saturate bread, beans, music. I wish they would come with me. The miner, the little girl, the lawyer, the seaman, the doll maker, to go into a movie and come out to drink the reddest wine. I did not come here to solve anything. I came here to sing and for you to sing with me. That was Paul Robeson. Thank you.
That was Lloyd Brown, close friend of Paul Robeson and author of Young Paul Robeson, On My Journey Now. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! For a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. When we come back, others will remember the giant Paul Robeson, born 100 years ago today. Stay with us.
The next is a setting of another chorale, it might be called, by Beethoven in the choral part of the Ninth Symphony, a very simple melody that, of course, he developed to tremendous proportions. But the melody itself is just a simple chorale. And the words of Schiller, all men are brothers.
Praise to joy the God descended, daughter of Elysium, ray of mirth and rapture blended, goddess, to thy shrine we come. By thy magic is united what stern custom parted light. All mankind are brothers plighted, where thy gentle wings abide.
I would no more dare to introduce Paul Robeson than I would dare to assume that anybody here would need an introduction to Paul Robeson.
It began when I was a...
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. One of the issues that surfaced at this weekend's meeting celebrating the life and legacy of Paul Robeson that took place at Columbia University, sponsored by The Nation magazine and Pacifica station WBAI. One of those issues was Robeson's relationship with the Communist Party. Robeson had long been vilified in the U.S. press for being a communist, and he was dragged before the House Un-American Activities Committee and then punished for refusing to name names and answer questions about both his own relationship with the Communist Party. But this past March, the People's Weekly World, the Communist Party newspaper, reported Robeson was in fact a member of the party. Gerald Horn, a professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, raised the issue at a panel of distinguished academics, activists, and journalists at the Robeson celebration. Professor Horn first asked Victor Novasky, the publisher of the weekly news magazine The Nation and the author of Naming Names, a book about the McCarthy witch hunts of the 50s, whether the new report about Robeson's membership in the party should change the evaluation of Robeson. Victor Novasky.
It seemed to me that the American left, including the Communist Party, was wrong about what was happening in the Soviet Union during those years and right about what was happening in this country. And that there was an ideal, and they were right about what was happening in with regard to fascism in Europe, which is very important and one of the great struggles of that period. And that Paul Robeson was part of that larger movement. The most important thing that he stood for and that he did and that the people who resisted the Un-American Activities Committee did, it seemed to me, was to resist this strain of repression and intolerance that has been part, one half of the American theme. The going back to the Alien and Sedition Acts, the attacks on the Wobblies after World War I, McCarthyism, and right up to some things that are happening in the country today with regard to immigration. You have this very repressive theme in American history, standing against the Jeffersonian, free speech, Tom Paine, other theme, and their intention with each other, and he was on the right side of that struggle. When I was researching Naming Names, I interviewed one of the, which is a book about the McCarthy period, I interviewed one of the, a lot of former members of the party, and one of them said something to me which I think applies to Robeson in particular, and that is, he said, where is it written that you can't be a Marxist and in favor of free speech? And that, it seems to me, is a very important observation about members of the Communist Party in this country. The joke was that the Communist Party was like the Brooklyn Bridge. It was suspended on cables from Moscow because they did get the party line from Moscow. But one of the reasons the party had this great turnover was there were a lot of free thinkers and independent people in that organization, in and around it. And because it was the object of such great attacks, it was a sign of nobility not to desert it when it was being attacked for the wrong reasons, which is what was happening in this country, it seems to me. So Robeson, I want to say one other thing about, which goes a little beyond your question, but I think it's important. The difference between Robeson and virtually every other person who was a victim, a target, of the red hunt, of this vast, pervasive set of investigations, inquisition, if you will, that was going on in this country. Not just the Un-American Activities Committee, not just McCarthy, not just the FBI. There were police red squads in virtually every city in the country. There was little anti-Un-American Activities Committee state by state. There was a subversive activities control board. There was an attorney general's list of subversive organizations. The difference between Robeson and everyone else is they were called, as he was, before the Un-American Activities Committee. And for them to get off and resume normal lives, they had to denounce themselves and then name the names of others who had been members of the party with them. Robeson, and they either went along or resisted, as Robeson did. Robeson was different because in the case of the Afro-American community, Afro-Americans were called before that committee, and for them to, including Jackie Robinson, great baseball player, and for them to survive in this culture, they had to denounce Paul Robeson. He became the litmus test, and you didn't have to name anyone else. It was good enough if you denounced Paul Robeson, particularly his statements about what Americans fight in a war against the Soviet Union. And that made him even more of symbolic importance than everything else. And finally, I would say, that there's a lot of talk today about the legacy of Paul Robeson. It seems to me, looking at this audience, unfortunately, that he is a memory. And until I see a lot more Columbia-age students out there, it's your job and our job to make the best part of him a legacy.
Would anyone else on the panel care to comment on some of these points that Victor Nagoski has raised?
Just one word.
Sure.
Robeson colleague, Lloyd Brown.
Whether Paul Robeson was a member of the Communist Party or not. I was as close to Paul Robeson for years as anyone, and as close as was Benjamin J. Davis Jr., who was a black leader of the Communist Party. Now, so far as Ben Davis was concerned, friend, Paul was not a member of the Communist Party. That's what he told me. Paul Robeson told me the same thing. He was not a member of the Communist Party. He had testified before the Tenney Committee in California that he wasn't a member of the Communist Party, but when he answered that, he said, he's not a member, but he does know of the positive role that communists are playing in the fight against fascism, against racism, and so he was a supporter of them. That was Paul Robeson's position. Now, I think it's only some kind of cheap opportunism for somebody to come out and say, yes, He was a member of our party. All of you people were cheering him. Now you're really following us. I think it's like some stumble bump gets in front of a parade and says, oh, they're all following me.
That was Lloyd Brown. Next up was Margaret Burnham. Oh. Margaret Burnham, who was a judge in New York City, her family a close friend of the Robesons. She was a lawyer, formerly with the head of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. Her father, Louis Burnham, a well-known member of the Communist Party. She remembers Robeson.
Gerald, on your earlier question, whether or not Paul Robeson was a member of the Communist Party, I think that we ought to rely on Lloyd Brown's approach, which is that Paul Robeson told us what his political perspectives and views and allegiances and alliances were in his book, Here I Stand. That is the legacy that he left with us. To continue to question whether or not he was a member of the Communist Party is to harken back to the old days when that question, are you or are you not a member, defined the man. Paul Robeson refused to be defined by that question. And to continue to participate in the discussion of that is to continue that my parents, Louis Burnham and Dorothy Burnham, were not religious people. They were political people. But there were two gods in our house, and they grew up with us. And those gods, of course, were Dr. Du Bois and Paul. And I thought of them that way as a child. And only today, in listening to Ossie Davis's cogent analysis of the sum totality of Paul Robeson, do I now realize that that God was really an archetypical socialist man. That was Paul was, his photos hung in our home. We children were named after him. His feats, his intellectual accomplishments, his songs were the bread and butter of our lives as we grew up. I can recall when we went to visit him, it was like church. We were brushed up and put clean clothes put on, and our shoes were cleaned, and we were minded of our manners, and we would go and visit with him. And of course, as was said earlier, we're struck by the enormity of this man, of his voice, of his talent, of his intellect, and of his enormous frame that held all of that, and of his courage. But as children as well, what he was able to do was to transcend the personality, the name Paul Robeson, and to meet with us one-on-one with humility, as Esther Jackson expressed it. I can recall as a child going to AME Zion Church where Paul Robeson would be there, and Christmas he would be dressed as Santa Claus, and he would have a kind word for each of us and ask us about our lives and our studies. The other point that I think I can bring to this gathering that's unique to my experience, having grown up in a home where Paul Robeson stood as the towering figure, was that to have that perspective gave us a perspective on race that was different from what the operative paradigm of the moment was, what the lifting as we climb paradigm that each individual success will enable and help the race itself to survive and prevail. And with Paul Robeson as a model, as a hero, race was certainly a point of departure. It was a launching pad for our lives. But as well, it did not completely define our lives. Rather, he saw his race and his membership in the Negro, among the Negro people, as being a core from which he could explore the world. And it was that he brought to us at a period of time in the 1950s when our lives were confined and constrained in every way by segregation. Even growing up here in New York City, where we went to segregated schools, to hear this man sing in the voice of our people, Danny Boy, and Joe Hill, produced a kind of internationalism and married our race pride with that internationalism in a way that would form the basis for our life, became a canvas upon which we would paint our lives of struggle. That's what Paul Robeson gave to me.
Judge Margaret Burnham of New York, part of a panel this weekend sponsored by Pacifica Station WBAI and Columbia University's Institute for Research in African American Studies. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we end with the words of Paul Robeson at another Pacifica station, KPFA, the founding station of the Pacifica Network, in a 1958 interview with Elsa Knight Thompson.
I wonder, Mr. Robeson, if we could kick off by asking, when did you first become involved in the political aspects of...
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. I've been on two or three others this time, but always have been... know I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you. I would say, as I indicate in a recent book which is now out, it will be on the stands pretty soon, Here I Stand, Story of My Life as I Tell It, not too autobiographical. It began when I was a little boy in Princeton, New Jersey. Strange to say. Technically, this is the shaping of my views, a Negro boy born in Princeton, New Jersey, in a college town where the students mainly came from the Deep South. You know, Princeton, and Princeton, Harvard, and Yale was the sort of the Southern University of the North, whether you know that or not. And so I grew up in Jersey in a rather Southern atmosphere. And my father was a minister, and I was shaped against that background. Technically, I entered the sort of the arena in the United States of fighting for social justice for my people in a concert, when I was in a concert in St. Louis in 1947, in the Post-Dispatch, where I was singing at the Kiel Auditorium, one of the big auditoriums there. And the NAACP asked me in St. Louis at that time to come on a picket line because Negro people could not even sit in the theater, which was just across the street. And so I grabbed a banner, and lo and behold, I saw Walter Houston coming down the street. He was in the play. So Walter walked out and joined the picket line too. And a few nights later, when I was doing the concert, I said that I could not quite resolve the contradiction between singing to an audience in St. Louis, where there was no segregation, of course, but also the same people had not, to my mind, were not fighting to see that my people could sit in the theater. It's been corrected since. And so I said that I was giving up my career technically for the moment to enter the realm of the day-to-day struggle of the Negro people, especially.
Plantators, he don't plant cotton. Them that plants him.
And so we end our Paul Robeson special and continue the legacy of that giant on this 100th anniversary of his birth. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. For a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Samori Marksman. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying, and all a man